South Florida is a paradise for everyone, including fraudsters and scam artists. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We recently told you about the largest Medicare fraud scheme in U.S. history. It spanned nationwide, and some of the people arrested lived here in South Florida. This region has become a hub for these scams. We'll talk with one of the agents running the investigations out of Miami. Also, we'll take a deep dive into Miami's Wynwood neighborhood. It's growing and expanding, but that also means growing pains. There's a plan to make some of the streets pedestrian-friendly. We'll find out when that happens. And which group do you think had the greatest influence on the evolution of Wynwood? That's the basis of a new special series called Wynwood Stories.
Nobody would have ever cared. And no artists would have come here, and no galleries would have opened up.
It's playing now at the Wynwood Yard weeks before the yard shuts down. All of that today on Sundial. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. South Florida has long been a target for Medicare fraud cases. It's such an issue here that the Office of Inspector General and the U.S. Justice Department developed a Medicare fraud strike force based in Miami, which has prosecuted more cases than any other team in the country. Well, just last week, the largest Medicare fraud telemarketing scheme in the nation was broken up with two dozen people charged in a scheme that took the government for more than $1.2 billion. Two of the men charged in the scheme were from Boca Raton. Now, we heard about the case from reporter Jane Musgrave from the Palm Beach Post on Tuesday, and you can hear that conversation online at WLRN.org. Joining me now in studio is the assistant special agent in charge, Brian Martins. Sir, thank you so much for joining me today.
Absolutely. I'm glad to be here.
Let me start with this. Why is South Florida so ripe for the sort of scams and frauds that we keep hearing about? What's so special about this place?
Well, South Florida has been in this healthcare fraud arena for years, you know, tens of years. And although we can't really specifically say what that reason is, there is a larger portion of seniors that are retired in Florida is one of those. And it seems like we've just seen, we follow the Medicare fraud and we see trends where it just moves from one type of fraud scheme to another. And that's just been going on, and it's become almost part of the culture down here.
And you've been here for a while. I mean, besides this last case, which, again, the biggest in the nation, but what are one or two other big cases that you've seen in your time? And, again, you've seen so much of it.
So, we've had this DME, a different type of DME scheme many years ago, and then it's kind of evolved into other types of fraud schemes as we've attacked them.
And DME is?
A durable medical, yeah.
Okay.
Which is the case that we're talking about or that had come up earlier this last week with the takedown. One of those would be in the HIV infusion fraud, which was a big thing in the late 2000s. And there was a huge case with the Benitez brothers, which had assets going into the Dominican Republic. They were building a water park with their fraud proceeds down there. So that was a significantly big case that occurred here. And then more recently, just the other day, was the skilled nursing facility where after a long trial here in Miami, Philippus Formis was convicted in that matter. And that was over $1 billion related fraud scheme for skilled nursing facilities.
It was, I believe, 2014, you testified in front of Congress specifically about steps to take to prevent Medicare fraud. What were you hoping that lawmakers would learn from your experience here and everything you told them?
Well, I think the most important thing at that time was to discuss about beneficiaries and, you know, the importance of a role that they play and how we protect them. And so this case kind of, this national telemedicine case we're kind of talking about a little bit, dovetails into that in the sense that, you know, we want to protect beneficiaries and we also want them to be part of the solution. And when they see things that aren't actually provided to them, that they basically report it. Because a lot of times people don't report. And that helps the whole system so that the administrative contractors can take actions and then as well as the referrals can come to law enforcement.
How much of, I guess, the criminal element, how much of it has changed in the digital age? Is that made it better for them, better, tougher for you?
Well, you adapt and overcome. So we use new technologies to go after that. So in some ways, with social media and everything else, while we all communicate that way, it's also a help for us to help try to locate people sometimes. The technology allows us to look at big data quicker, to potentially identify where there may be data concerns about the types of claims and things that are being submitted. But it also allows them to hide behind the scenes a little bit more as well. So it's got its pluses and minuses, I would say.
All right, let's look at the this most recent case. Again, the largest in U.S. history. You put together an interesting infographic that explains how it worked and breaks it down into five parts. And we posted this, by the way, on our social media, WLRN Sundial, so you can follow along. You could at least get a basic rundown of how this happened. Let's start at the top. Who's running this operation? Was there? Is it one person, a group of people? What? How did that work?
So in this, there's a lot of co-conspirators, if you want to say that. Obviously, we can't talk too much into the ongoing details outside of what's in the DOJ press release there. But basically, you had some people that were outlined there that were essentially establishing these call centers. And the call centers are in the process of basically making phone calls out to individuals, potentially cold calling them to get information, to solicit beneficiaries about the need for these braces. The other side, which is kind of unique and interesting to this, was these television ads, radio ads, online ads. So they were soliciting on television. So people seeing advertisements for, you know, back braces, knee braces, things to help you, was actually part of the scheme.
So they were running ads to get you to call in, or they were cold calling you, one of the two.
Yes. So there's a possibility of them of purchasing or obtaining leads lists, which leads lists are considered lists of Medicare beneficiaries that they will get information on to call outside of the advertisements.
That's who they're targeting, is the Medicare beneficiaries. That's their target.
Yes.
Are the doctors that are writing these prescriptions for these Medicare braces, are they operating fraudulently, or do they know what's happening?
So I guess we have to look at each one individually, but I think in this case you can see from the press release that there were specifically two physicians that were charged in this matter, I think one out of New Jersey and one out of Pennsylvania, for that very thing, and it outlines that. So as we're working individual cases, the assessment of whether or not they were complicit or involved will be addressed between the agents and working with the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Department of Justice, whether or not we should charge them based upon the individual case.
So again, I'm looking at that chart, and so it's, again, they start with the ads or they're cold calling, and they're targeting specifically these the Medicare beneficiaries, and they're trying to get you to say, yes, I need one of these braces. And then that is going to a different company to try to get the order.
Right. So they basically then are going to link it to a group that is associating with a number of physicians. And that's where potentially somewhere is the doctors can be duped a little bit in that they believe they're providing a service through a third party telemedicine related company. And that telemedicine company has these people that they need to talk to. So that's where that part goes. So they allegedly link up the beneficiary with a physician. Now, in some cases, the physician actually does talk to the beneficiary. In some cases, I think was egregious in one of the individuals charged, it kind of alleged that he wasn't even talking to anybody. Like, he was just approving these things. And in some cases, the beneficiaries that are even contacted about the braces say, no, I don't want this thing. And they still see the stuff coming to their house. With some doctor having signed that. And so when that, once that's signed, then that document or the doctor's order prescription is routed back to those group that owns the call center. And once it gets to the call center, there's arrangements between the call centers and various durable medical equipment companies where they will essentially sell or transmit those scripts. And then from those durable medical equipment companies, the actual device will be serviced or provided to that beneficiary.
Did I misread when I was looking through that chart? Is that basically at that point, these call centers, they're selling this information. They're selling the information they've gathered of the beneficiaries. They're just selling it.
Yes. And or there may be arrangements like the simplest thing for everybody is that it is being sold. Okay. There may be systemic ways that they're trying to work around the actual term of selling.
So they need these doctors that you cannot get it without the doctor's signature. And once they do, then they're placing the order, whether the patient wanted it or not.
Correct.
Needed it or not. And then that money, they're billing Medicare.
Correct.
They're billing Medicare. And then there's just, they're now siphoning that money off to kickbacks to different groups.
Correct. And the durable medical equipments that are getting the money may be sporadically and all over the country, not necessarily isolated to the geographic area of where the doctor or the patient are.
Do these medical equipment companies have any way of determining whether or not the requests that are coming in are legitimate?
Well, a lot of these durable medical equipment companies may be are complicit with the fraud scheme. And so that, again, like, we can't really say specifically until we evaluate each case independently and have that discussion from the evidence we have. But there are some that clearly are involved with that.
And, you know, we said nationally, but, I mean, wasn't there also, like, some of this was, international as well?
Oh, absolutely. Like, you talk about the call centers. There's ways. The call centers are not governed by Medicare in any way because they're not providing a service in that sense to the government or to beneficiaries of the government. So a lot of these people will set things up overseas in foreign countries, just like we were talking about technology being used. That's part of this process, which, again, makes it more difficult for us as law enforcement to attack the problem. But we work through it and find ways, like in this case.
I'm speaking with Assistant Special Agent in Charge Brian Martins. Last week, the Justice Department, along with the Office of Inspector General, announced charges against two dozen people in a $1.2 billion Medicare fraud scheme. You can learn more about that case on our website at WLRN.org. As much as you can tell me, Mr. Martins, is how agents were able to unravel this scheme. How long does it take? I mean, you talk about data, for example, and you can look at the data and sometimes see anomalies and things that are going on that may lead you to something. But as much as you can tell us, how did you guys find them?
Well, I think in this case, the relative point was is that they ultimately, this goes back to about August of 2018, where they kind of developed a lot of the stuff related to this. And then since then, it was working through various levels to get to the point we're at today. And when you have these large schemes that are heavily involved, and in this case involved international stuff, that creates another level to get through. That's kind of the timetable or frame. But we will see things that will jump off at us. Like, these were braces. So if you think about it, once you have a brace scheme that you're going, you look at what the braces are that they're billing, and then who else is billing for them. And, are there anomalies with those companies that we need to look into as well?
And it's something you said to me earlier before we started this program was that, you know, if you can shut down something in one area, then they just move to another. They're always looking for the next place.
Right.
Right?
Yes, absolutely. So it's creative. We're always we're learning from defendants once they're charged, and a lot of them then want to potentially cooperate. So we learn about how they're doing things, and also we're proactively trying to identify where things may be going. And that's where, like, the data trends help, but also street information, intelligence, and as well as the Medicare beneficiaries, which we keep coming back to, is their ability to, when they get their Medicare summary notice, which lays out what was billed and what was charged under their account, a lot of people just leave them on the side, don't do much with them. And we just say the most important thing is to check. And if you, at least the company, did you receive something from them? Did you not? And if you didn't or you shouldn't have and they billed, like, report that. There's numbers there to report it on to CMS directly, or we also have our HHS hotline that they can call into.
The Miami Medicare Fraud Strike Force has successfully prosecuted more cases than any other group in the country. Is it that you're able to stay ahead of the criminals? Are they just careless? What's with the, the success rate is impressive.
Yes. We like to think that.
I mean, a pat on the back. You guys are doing a great job, but I'm just wondering.
Well, I appreciate that. And I think the most important thing there is the collaboration we've had in South Florida between the U.S. Attorney's Office, which do a great job prosecuting it, along with the Department of Justice, and then our partners at the FBI and a number of other federal and or local law enforcement agencies that collaborate with us. So that's been a key to it. And I like to think that we're very aggressive, both prosecutorial and investigatively wise. And we're always looking for that one-off. What's happening? What's new? Let's get into it. Let's attack that and make things happen.
I wonder, too, is if we're seeing a different kind of criminal in South Florida. Is there something unique about South Florida?
You know, I don't know that I could say what specifically is unique. It's almost like it's been here for so long That it's just one of those things. We've added more resources, and you know, we, as we attack things and take action, they move to something else. I think the best thing that we do also is we share the information through the prosecutions with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for them to look at potentially taking action to change the Medicare rules to make it more difficult in those areas. Because we'll see schemes that from South Florida as ground zero that will start here and will migrate across the entire country.
Now let's talk about how people can protect themselves. Because a lot of people were victim in this in this scheme, and they didn't know what was going on. But something you said to me sounds simple, but it's a challenge to get people to do it. Basically, don't answer your phone because scammers are still using the phone.
Right. I think that the most important thing is you're a beneficiary, you're thinking about a loved one, is that you, when somebody calls your house and you potentially answer that phone, the question is, do you actually need to talk to that person? And, you know, nowadays with so many robocalls, I think that we all receive, the question is, if you don't know the number, why even answer? But if for some reason you do answer the phone, if they start to ask you about your Medicare number or knee or back braces or something that we can give you free or reduced, the question is, who should you be talking to about your medical situation, your diagnosis, what issues you have? Usually we all have a doctor that we trust, and that's the person we should be talking to.
You know what, with the beneficiaries, I mean, are all the beneficiaries in this case victims, or were any of them involved?
Well, I can't really talk to that, obviously, in this matter, but in general, you know, in various schemes we've had throughout South Florida, sometimes they are complicit, and a lot of cases they are not. So even those that sometimes may have been complicit, the difficult thing there is they may be complicit for one, and then the problem is the bad guys have your information, and then they sell it to other unscrupulous providers. So we can see them maybe had been complicit in one thing, but then all the other billing that goes, they weren't complicit for.
The other thing, too, is this. So be careful when you're taking phone calls. But the other thing is just, hey, if it's not your doctor, check with your doctor.
Absolutely. I mean, and if you don't have a specific doctor you normally go to, who are the loved ones? Is it family, friends, children, parents that you can talk to about what that situation is? Because once the bad guys get your information, they're not necessarily just going to, you know, do that for this one provider. They're potentially going to sell that in leads list to other organizations or groups that are billing for other things. And that's why I would say it's critical to look at your Medicare benefits summary notice. And if you see things that you didn't get or didn't see, please report those to us.
And yeah, and so if you're afraid that your information is out there, or again, you're receiving things that you don't remember getting, then there is a place. I mean, you can basically call in and say, look, this is not right. Something's not right here.
Yeah, absolutely. Through, I think you guys have posted the one. So through our website, there's an online hotline portal that they can do, or there's the 1-800-HHS-TIPS, which is 447-8477. But those are ways to get it across, as well as through your Medicare benefits summary to report it.
Briefly, what else do you tell people about protecting themselves?
You know, it's hard not to answer the phone, but the most important thing to me is to say your medical background, your health records are yours and they're personal to you. Why would you share them with somebody who's not your physician?
If you don't know the person, you know, just use that as maybe the starting point. Again, talking about, you know, Medicare fraud schemes and other schemes here in South Florida, we've been talking with Assistant Special Agent in charge of this last issue, this last case, we should say, is Brian Martins. He is a special agent in charge here in South Florida. And if you want to know more about the stories, any of these stories, these things that happen here in South Florida, go on our website, WLRN.org. Check out, again, the diagram that we've got to show you how this last scheme kind of worked, but also it has the number, the information there, if you want to call in, if you think that this may be happening to you. Mr. Martins, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. I appreciate it.
All right. Still to come, a deep dive into Miami's Wynwood neighborhood. What steps are being taken to make the tourist hub more pedestrian friendly? That's coming up next on the program. Thank you. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Wynwood has become a major tourist destination for the city of Miami, attracting nearly 20% of the tourists that came to the region for 2017. That's more than double from the previous year, according to data from the Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau. The increase in tourism has led to more pedestrian traffic on the streets as folks explore the nightlife and the arts that the neighborhood has to offer. The Wynwood Business Improvement District unveiled a plan to address this growing demand. Along with new trees planted and public art spaces, there is a proposal to develop three streets into so-called Wynwerf. These are Dutch-style streets that have three lanes, one for traffic, one for pedestrians, and one for cyclists. They've already begun work on the Northeast 3rd Avenue from 25th to 29th Street. WLRN producer Chris Remington spoke with Vice President Ben Hutchins of Arquitectonica GEO and the group responsible for designing several of the new streets, and Albert Garcia of Wynwood Business Improvement District, BID.
Several years ago, the Wynwood Business Improvement District, as it always does, plans for the neighborhood's future, started to pick up on that. While Wynwood, of course, is a haven for street art, world-renowned for that, there's a desire for people that also visit that they want to stay. They want to spend more time. What does that really mean, truly, that they want to work there? And they also want to explore living options in the neighborhood. So as we start planning for its future, we have to account for not just the entertainment and the tourism that, of course, has put Wynwood on the international scene, and efforts like what we're talking about today with a streetscape master plan that's being spearheaded by Arquitectonica GEO, looks at how do you balance all of those different interests.
Is this vision predominantly designed then for the residents, for the folks that are going to be living here, or is it also to continue attracting the large tourist population?
It's both. And that's really, I think, Wynwood's special moment and opportunity to continue to preserve that. Our tourism numbers year after year double. We experienced over 4 million international visitors alone last year. The year before that, it was close to 2.5 million. That's a one-year increase of almost double. And those numbers are going to continue, and we intend to ensure that those numbers continue to move in that direction. But as residents come in and start to stabilize the cycle of what Wynwood is, because as we know, the tourism market tends to slow down over the summer months, so you need to have those pockets of shade for the residents and for the tourists alike. If we want them to walk around the neighborhood, which is a 50-block commercial district, we need to give them those pockets of opportunity to be able to exhale, take in the moment that they're, of course, being enamored with the street art, with the independent retailers, and encourage them to continue walking. We pride ourselves in being one of the most pedestrian-oriented neighborhoods in South Florida, but it's difficult to do that in the Miami weather when you have no trees.
A key part of this streetscape master plan is based off of this Dutch-inspired street design idea of Wynwerf. There's three different ones of these that are part of the greater plan. Ben, can you begin by describing what exactly a Wynwerf is and how it works?
A Wynwerf, as you mentioned, is a Dutch-inspired street typology. And Miami's looking to sort of adopt that idea in a way that you're creating really more equity between users, meaning equity between cars, pedestrians, and bicycles. So you still are able to accommodate the car, but you're really starting to push the pedestrian zones and really minimizing the vehicular zones and giving that area and allocating it to the pedestrian, to the bike lane, so that it becomes a space. And it really does start to create public space in this district that is really lacking that. And I think it really starts to create a new conversation for the greater Miami and the city in saying, hey, you know, these rights of ways, as the city becomes more and more dense, this area becomes more and more valuable for people and how it's used.
It's interesting. I spent some time in Amsterdam last year, and a number of these streets are designed like that, where you have the lane for pedestrian, cyclist, and vehicle all together. And so is that in sort of the design of the streets themselves? Is it in the materials you use? Is it kind of the infrastructure? How do you actually create those spaces?
I think one thing that's great is in this case, we're looking at three different streets for this.
Yeah.
So it's a great opportunity to explore different ways to do it. And each street has its own character, its own context, its own identity. And using materials, using form, and looking at how people can move through the space, and you can look at creating structure or creating no structure. And really, it could be almost like a plaza condition with trees, where there is no definition of this zone is for this or that, or where, on the other hand, you could start to define these edges a little better for safety. And so it's really trying to maintain that balance. but really make it feel more of a place to be for people, I think, is the main goal.
I think an important part about this, too, and you had spoken about this a little while ago, Albert, is the mentality in South Florida about drivers and the automobile first. And so I'm wondering about those conversations in terms of the culture playing out, in terms of what are these streets for? How do we begin those conversations with the residents as well as the businesses there?
You know, we live in this Uber, Lyft, shared economy marketplace now where we look at cars not solely as my car, but cars that we share and as modes of transportation to resolve some of the larger mass transit challenges that we have here in South Florida, but are not unique to South Florida by any means. But in Wynwood, when we speak to the executives at Uber and Lyft, they'll tell us that Wynwood out-indexes any other neighborhood in South Florida for pickups and drop-offs. So what that tells us is that people that are coming here, whether they're coming in their own car or they're using rideshare, they're getting dropped off or parking their car once and then spending the afternoon or the evening walking around the neighborhood. So in South Florida, we have this mindset that we've kind of, I guess, for a lack of a better term, embraced, that you park your car and then you have to get back in your car again if you want to move three blocks or five blocks. And in Wynwood, that just isn't the case. We've seen that already. And our role here now is just to optimize the conditions to further encourage that. And, you know, we have a 50-block district that, you know, is now designed and optimized and will, through this plan, be more hospitable to that pedestrian-first experience.
Logistically, do we have the plan set in place in terms of how traffic could be interrupted in the interim?
One of the beauties and, I think, consistencies in Wynwood's past, present, and I would dare to say its future, is that it's always in a constant change of reinvention. I really do see Wynwood as a microcosm of what we're experiencing now in Greater Miami, that this explosion of cultural expression, institutions that are here, whether it's the Arch, the PAM, and Wynwood, of course, and the role it's played in shaping that identity for Miami. But as Wynwood continues to evolve, you know, we always do take into consideration how to mitigate those disturbances and those interruptions so that Wynwood can continue to function as a living, breathing neighborhood that isn't paralyzed because of one single project. This isn't Wynwood's plan to become Coral Gables. Again, no offense to Coral Gables listeners. And Wynwood has its own identity, and we certainly are firmly aware of what that is. And it's just refinements to account for modern conditions that require pick up and drop off points, for example, for your Amazon packages. Those are things that we already see, and with more residents, that's going to be more common. So we need to account for these rideshare pickup and drop off points.
I'm speaking with Arquitectonica Geo Vice President Ben Hutchins and Wynwood Business Improvement District Vice Chair Albert Garcia about some of the projects in place for the Greener Wynwood Streetscape Project. Albert, is there a way that we can put an economic value on putting this type of foliage into cityscape? Have there been research studies looking at these projects in terms of the economic value generated to kind of get a sense of what the long-term investment is?
You know, that's an excellent question. We're certainly in the early stages of our design mm-hmm. and exploration, but certainly this is not an easy lift by any stretch. We're not talking about planting a few palm trees and calling it a day. There's certainly a lot that goes into this, you know, but we do want to insert gestures that will accommodate street furniture, landscaping, and all of these components. I think certainly speak to the economic, you know, component that we see for Wynwood, that it will continue to foster its growth and its exponential rate of attraction. But I think one critical thing is, do we lose ourselves in that process? And Ben has been really at the spearhead of that debate and that balancing act.
Right. So we've been working closely with the community and stakeholders, and since day one, it's been very clear that there's interest in preserving and maintaining the industrial character of that space, and clearly understanding that, you know, when people start living there, it starts to evolve and it starts to change over time, and we feel that having these amenities, having the landscape element, having gracious sidewalks, and accommodating, you know, creating a more livable environment is very important in the future of this place. But there's that balancing act between making it too cush, too cute, but and still maintaining that grit and that rawness that I think that community has, and finding a way to make that happen. And I think we're getting there. We're getting close.
Yeah, and also don't forget crosswalks and wayfinding. These are very basic elements that are currently lacking in Wynwood that are also mm-hmm. contemplated. So this is not about just planting trees and beautifying the neighborhood. That's not what this exercise is about. It's also looking at our pedestrians, making sure that they can get across the neighborhood safely, crossing from intersection to intersection, and also understanding where they are and where the nearest bus shelters are, trolley stops, other forms of transit to make for a more informed pedestrian.
And Ben, you use the word community, and I'm wondering if you could be more specific. Who are you specifically hearing from, and what are they telling you?
Yes. So currently there's not too many residents in the area. So we did have residents, but more from adjacent areas, right, where you have the single family homes and the multifamily homes. But certainly a lot of business owners, operators, a lot of developers, and a lot of community members from around the area. And I think people also just who really care about Wynwood.
Yeah, and part of the reason I asked that I was part of an interesting discussion that happened in Wynwood a couple weeks ago that was talking about the future of the neighborhood. And really at the core of that was the issue of gentrification and a lot of the artists that have already been pushed out of the neighborhood. A lot of this conversation centers around who is being included in those discussions for the development.
To your question about the community involvement, we've had close to 24 public meetings where we've invited the general public, stakeholders both inside Wynwood and those that call Wynwood their home in their hearts, to come in and be a part of this process. We had a phenomenal event at the end of last year where literally we had people that probably hadn't set foot in Wynwood in over 5 years coming back and being very excited about the opportunity to be heard, to give their take on where Wynwood is, where it was, where it should go, and working together with ArcGeo, the Wynwood Bid, the City of Miami Planning Department, you know, we've worked together to kind of reconcile all of those different anecdotes into this plan. So this plan certainly earmarks places for art. All the new projects that are coming into Wynwood have to go through a litany of scrutiny as far as their facades. They have to allocate space for mural arts or other artistic and architectural elements to be true to that art history that, you know, obviously has catapulted us now into the national scene. So that's not going anywhere. We're only going to see more of that. So street art isn't going anywhere. Certainly it is evolving. It is changing. But our DNA is the same. And we don't never, I think, will lose sight of that.
So can you give us a sense of what the timeline looks like for the bigger project? What are the next steps that people can kind of look ahead to in terms of May and the summer?
Sure. So we've been meeting every month, public meetings where ArcGeo and our other experts have been presenting progress sets.
Right. So we've been working on it since about summertime last year. We're kind of in the home stretch. I think we've worked through, you know, a lot of meetings with the community, meetings with the city and the bid, and really started to shape what we think is the vision and what the vision is starting to come to be. And then now it's just a matter of organizing that into a set of guidelines so that when projects come online and they start getting built, they can implement these ideas and the intent through their project. Personally, we'll be finished with this project by summertime, but it's a long-term vision. I mean, this thing, you know, it's the whole district, and really, as Wynwood grows organically over time, these things come online and get implemented. So it's really a long-term project.
So we don't foresee the entire 50-block district snapping to this vision overnight, but it does set the tone and the direction for the community to continue to strive as it moves towards its future.
Well, you heard from Vice President Ben Hutchins of Arquitectonica GEO and Vice Chair Albert Garcia of Wynwood Business Improvement District talking with producer Chris Remington about some of the projects taking place in Wynwood to make it better for pedestrians and make it greener. And by the way, find us on Facebook at WLRN Sundot. Love to hear your thoughts. What would you do to make Wynwood better for pedestrians and drivers? All right, still to come, we're going to stay in Wynwood. A new show already started in Wynwood. Wynwood Stories, that's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the Wynwood neighborhood is changing as the landscape and the community continue to evolve. That evolution is the backdrop for a new theatrical production from the Juggernaut Theater Company, creators of Miami Motel Stories. Wynwood Stories, which started this week, looks at the many different eras and characters that made up the Wynwood community over the decades. Since there's no motel for the series, performances take place in makeshift stages like a kitchen, a bar, and along a graffiti-covered wall. Now, the focus of the show is centered around this question: who is responsible for what Wynwood has become? You're going to hear the stories of a seamstress, a developer, a baker, a graffiti artist, and the owner of a gallery, all making their case. Wynwood Stories is the curtain call for the Wynwood Yard, an outdoor food hall and event space that's called the neighborhood home for nearly 4 years. It's moving locations to Doral and North Miami Beach in the coming months. The yard, along with the adjacent O Cinema, is about to close for the development of a giant apartment complex. The Sundial team recently stopped by at one of the rehearsals and spoke with Juan C. Sanchez, the writer of the Miami Motel Stories and the new Wynwood Stories. And you can hear our earlier conversation with Sanchez about Miami Motel Stories on our social media at WLRN Sundial.
Yeah, this was a tough one because it happened really fast. When we spoke, which was right when MIMO was taking place, we did not know that this was not even in the works. It wasn't even in the plans. The Wynwood Yard creator, Della, she contacted us. She'd been to our previous pieces, and she was really in love with immersive theater and what we were doing and honoring the neighborhoods. And so she contacted Tanya and to tell her that the yard was closing, and she thought that us coming in and creating something in conjunction with the closing would be a really great way for her and for the yard to honor the neighborhood and the time that they've been here. And so it was like a week later. Oh, and she was like, and by the way, it's happening, they're closing in a month and a half, you know, something ridiculous like that. And we're like, oh my God, can we do this? And it was as much work as the other projects in a condensed time, you know, half the time.
Part of the experience is going to be that people will be dragged around by the actors because it's going to be a turf war.
Yes, that's exactly it. The space is a little serpentine, and, there are paths that lead you into different areas and different structures where, you know, containers and things like that. There are scenes that will take place in the operational kitchen, in the offices. So, yes, you're in a room or in a space or a station with an actor, maybe two. And while that character is telling you, this is why I'm Wynwood, this is what I did here, at some point there's an interruption, and you will be dragged in by another character who claims to have the real story about the neighborhood, and you'll end up in another station until another character. I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but yes, it's filled with interruptions and people trying to get your attention and asking you to believe them over everyone else.
The vibe. Second Saturday gallery walks, yes? We brought people into the neighborhood, into the galleries. Oh, it was amazing. People who were in.
Nobody would have ever paid attention. Nobody would have ever cared. And no artists would have come here, and no galleries would have opened up, and no building developers would have come and cop buildings. There would be no restaurants and no bars.
Me ahoga también. Every night I dream with zippers and sleeves, and it's not a good dream. No, it's a nightmare. Tremenda pesadilla, chico. Every night yo ahí sewing, and I never finish because the bags just multiply until they're like covering the whole room, and I'm drowning in the middle, and it's like I'm being swallowed by the bags.
You just heard part of the performances from Susie K. Taylor, Reynard Gabriel Garanchin, and Angelina Lopez de Catledge. As Juan Sanchez was telling us, each character represents a different era of Wynwood's history. Now, one piece is about a Cuban seamstress sharing her story of her daily toil making bags. In the 1950s and 60s, Wynwood was a popular site for fashion and apparel manufacturing facilities. We watched Angelina's performance and talked to her about her character and her understanding of the history of Wynwood.
I am playing the Cuban seamstress, so I'm representing a Cuban seamstress in the 1970s. She is a hard worker, she's very proud.
Parece de comedia, pero es una cosa de terror. She glues the high heels on the high heel shoes. Fuajata boom, fuajata boom, fuajata boom. 8 hours straight, like me, with the zippers and the sleeves.
She loves to sew. Unfortunately, her reality is much different than the reality that she had in Cuba. She's doing a different type of sewing where, you know, it's a factory type of sewing, and she is not being paid what she is worth. So she's telling us the story of her struggle and ultimately why she also does it, you know, to help her family later move forward.
Tell me about whatever research that you did to understand, you know, that person, the real person who was doing this back in the day here in this community.
Well, to understand the character, you know, I always like to come from a moment of truth as an actress. So I like to immerse myself with as much information as possible. So I like research, you know, what was the influx of all the Cuban people coming here, starting from the 1959 to like the 70s and all the different progressions that they came. I also looked up, you know, all the stories of Cuban seamstresses that came here, how their conditions were in the factories. You know, I also listened to music. I listened to a lot of the music from the time just to feel, you know, what was her world at that time, and just researching history from the time to immerse myself and feel like I am that person.
So what's it like for you when you do a performance like this, very different from your traditional theater where you have a fourth wall? Here we're with you in the space and you're making us part of the experience.
It's a completely different experience because, you know, the audience is in it with you as well. You know, and also at the same time, it's almost like we are mirrors. I'm telling a story that perhaps is not your story, but somehow you find yourself reflected in it. Maybe you knew somebody that had a mother that sewed. Maybe you are a seamstress yourself. I mean, that's the beauty of it, that because you are having like this dialogue with the audience, it's like this beautiful symbiosis. It's like a dance between you and them. And the things that I'm saying, you can also identify with, and you can chime in as well.
Anybody who's never experienced this, what do you tell them about how they should approach it?
They should approach it with an open heart. Just come and feel the stories, empathize with these characters, because these are stories that have to be told. These are stories that have to be heard. You know, as we move forward as humans, you know, we have to understand the past. To understand our present, we have to understand the past. So history is very important. No matter how much we try to erase it, there's echoes of history all around us and inside of us. So it's important to keep these stories alive.
Wynwood is well known for the Wynwood Walls. It's an open space to the public which showcases murals by artists from around the world who've been commissioned to put their work there. It's also become a favorite spot for tourists and an Instagram hotspot. But some local artists have argued it's also corporate commercialization of mural art. One of the performances in Wynwood Stories explores the original street artist of Wynwood, better known as taggers or graffiti artist. Reynard Gabriel Garanchin plays one of the graffiti artists from the 80s and 90s.
So growing up in Miami, I had a very close friend of mine who was into writing, and we would drive around as kids, and I would provide backup in certain scenarios, maybe. But that was the extent of my experience with it. I mean, I've seen it around, I've grown up around it, I've watched people paint, but I did have to prepare. I met a lot of wonderful artists in preparation for this, lots of very talented graffiti or graphers. I met Track 6, I met Chrome, I met Crook. It was very cool, among others. It was just very special, and I got to watch them speak about their stories, and I got to watch them do their thing too. So that was pretty cool.
What would they tell you though about, because it's part of the story that you're telling us, is what Wynwood was and what it's become, and then you have different kinds of artists, as your character pointed out.
Yeah.
What did they tell you about that?
Well, there were some opinions about the newer school. You know, the one thing that I've gathered is that the newer kids are so in the moment that they skip something that the older heads used to do, which was pay tribute to the past. You know, everybody always remembered where they came from. And that's one thing that's a common denominator among all the graphers, that they always say, like, these kids just aren't given, not necessarily the props or the shout outs, but like aren't like, you know, tipping the hat to where they learned it from. You know, like the first piece these kids saw wasn't theirs, you know? And that's one thing that was pretty strong among all the gentlemen that I got to meet. And I would say that's their main point. Because, like, some people, they don't like the muralist. Some people don't like, you know, the way that some of these kids will tag over your piece, you know. But it's most importantly that they just, they don't respect the rules, you know.
I mean, you love it here, right? And you owe me. Hey, I'm pissed because we haven't been acknowledged. Not really, not seriously. We haven't been given the same opportunities as the other softer artists have been given.
I mean, you know what I'm talking about, right? Right? Yeah, like, I don't need to say it out loud because it's not even worth my time.
Man, I'm talking about the murals, all right? Yeah, those clowns at Wynwood Walls.
One of the other things, too, that I think is really interesting is that aspect of the story of who really built Wynwood as it is today. So I wondered what their take is on what you've heard about their take on their role in turning Wynwood into what it is today.
I mean, they definitely turned Wynwood into what it is today. They definitely did. It's in my piece, too. You know, if it wasn't for them, nobody would have paid attention. You know, a lot of Miami graffiti artists don't get included in the rest of the world. You know, you think graffiti and, like, the media, or, like, not necessarily the media, but the culture has always been in New York or L.A. or something. And the Miami writers, they had a hard time getting up. So it was very cutthroat down here. And it was all about real style and real talent, you know. So they had it. It was a jungle out there for them when they were trying to get up. Now these kids today, they have a little easier time. So I very much think that the graffiti artists, especially some of the men that I got to meet, have contributed directly to creating this place.
Within the past decade, a number of art galleries have come and left the neighborhood. Susie K. Taylor plays a gallery owner, a homegrown Miamian. She remembers Wynwood as a very different space from when she was growing up.
I'm telling the story of the art gallerist, and she is very passionate about her work here, and she was given an opportunity and she took it, meaning she had a building and she decided to put art in it and make a gallery, and she's trying to explain how she built Wynwood into the art community it is today, basically, as well as other gallerists in the neighborhood.
Being from Miami, how do you view Wynwood, what it is, what it's become?
I remember when Wynwood was, like, we didn't know what to call it yet. I actually remember interviewing my friends who were artists from New World School of the Arts, and they were, like, in this area called Wynwood, and I was like, Wynwood? Like, I didn't know the name either. And I remember coming interviewing people because I thought, this is going to be something amazing. I remember that moment when it was really, what is this going to be? Like, people are putting money into this area? Like, what? And I remember that feeling, and I remember coming here also and, like, seeing galleries and opening doors and what's in this door and what's in this door, and it was all exciting. And then I do remember seeing the parties, and I remember this visceral feeling of feeling just terrified, absolutely terrified. And it wasn't because of my safety, it was because of the art. Like, there's no way for these two worlds to coexist. And I remember feeling like this isn't the right place for me either. Like, I felt like I was kind of starting to get a home here, and then I felt sort of like I don't belong here anymore, and it was sad. But, you know, then it kind of softened a little bit, and I feel like my son goes to school in the neighborhood at Miami Arts Charter, and it is like a safer place, and last time when I remember walking, you walk one street too far and you're in big trouble. So that's not here anymore. So, and I love how people know Wynwood, and that you can say Miami and they say, oh, Wynwood, and it's a nice, you know, it's a nice thing now. But it was hard to watch the beautiful rise and then how it went. And now I love it. I'm from Miami, so I love anything Miami. So.
And your character points to the fact that there's that always that conversation about gentrification.
Yes.
And so, I mean, you say now it's this nicer place, but
people who supported art, and that's why they came, even though it wasn't a good place to be at night, you know, but they came, they were here, and it was just, oh, it was the place to be. And then the rest of the city gradually caught on, and then the people changed. Those that were coming were here to party. I mean, I'm talking like a frat party, like a rave. Oh, yes, it was teenagers getting drunk on wine and throwing up.
Yeah. What do you say? You know that argument.
I can't imagine. Like, this wasn't my personal home, so I don't know what that must feel like. And I do know people in this exact situation who were forced out and did have to leave, and they didn't want to, and I'm sure felt a responsibility to their lineage to stay, which I feel is a huge part of, like, the heartbreak of gentrification is you felt like you – earned this spot in the world and someone's taking it away and you have to be the one to release it as a family member. It's very difficult to do that with anything. I can't imagine your home or a part of your business.
Wynwood Story is now going through May 4th. Wynwood Yard expected to close May 5th. There are multiple opportunities to catch the shows each week. You can see photos from our trip to Wynwood Story's rehearsals by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Thursday, April 18th. Coming up next week on the program, a new documentary premiering at the Outshine Film Festival looks at how transgender people are treated within the prison system. And as Earth Day approaches, how far does food travel to your child's school? A school in Broward won a national competition, and they're getting other schools involved. Go to our social media, WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great Friday, a great weekend. Talk to you again on Monday.